Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. Information at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And once again, I am glad that we can begin the morning show with State Representative Corey Mason from Racine, who is calling us from Philadelphia, which is, of course, the site of the dramatic events of this week's National Democratic Convention. And speaking of dramatic, last night was perhaps the most dramatic night yet, at least in some respects, at the Democratic Convention. Representative Corey Mason, describe from your perspective what unfolded last night.
Yeah, I mean, what we saw last night was really just an amazing presentation by, you know, so many amazing people. But I mean, obviously we got to hear from Joe Biden, the outgoing vice president, and he just gave an amazing speech. Then we heard from Tim Kaine, who will follow him as vice president. But then, you know, we heard from the president, who made the case for Hillary and made the case against Trumpism and made the case for America, really, and what it stands for. And we were all just sort of reminded just how bittersweet it will be, because he's so amazing as a president, but as a speaker and an orator, and losing him is going to be bittersweet for us, because he's just been an amazing leader for our party and for our country. And, you know, in many ways, this was sort of a valedictory political speech for him, because it's the last one he can give to a convention like this while he's still president. So it was such a great speech, and it was just a little bit of sadness, because we were realizing, you know, this is really the end of an era that that has served us all very well.
Right. That helps explain some of the tears that we saw in various people in the crowd.
Absolutely.
One thing I observed was, on the one hand, there were long stretches of time where I was astounded at how silent that huge crowd was.
Yeah.
I mean, just hanging on his every word.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there were a couple of different moments where there was the sound of one, maybe two kind of strident voices of derision in the background, which, of course, is kind of shocking when it's the President of the United States speaking. Was that something you were even aware of in the hall, or is that only something we could hear over the television and radio coverage?
Yeah, I certainly didn't notice that. I don't. I mean, we occasionally heard people say, you know, yeah, we love you, or, you know, you know, I think that, I mean, what was so interesting, though, about even if there were a few voices of derision, it was the case that the president made during his speech about, like, look, this is democracy's tough stuff. It doesn't, you know, we're not always all going to agree on every single issue, and it's messy and it's hard and it's a lot of work. And, you know, I thought it was so important that the president last night said he was feeling the burn, and how great it was that Bernie Sanders supporters were there and everything that they did for this race and for the Democratic Party and for this country by adding their voices to the process. I mean, it was a very important and a well-deserved shout-out that the president gave to Bernie Sanders and his millions of supporters across the country.
Hmm.
So you know, Monday morning, it was much more raucous in terms of Sanders supporters and where they were and yelling out. And you know, it was not a hall divide or you know, that was unified on Monday morning. Certainly after Bernie gave his speech Monday night calling for unity and a full-throated endorsement of Hillary, that abated substantially. And then last night, you know, it was really a great acknowledgement of everything that this party is and how important it is for us to all come together and elect Hillary Clinton this November. But only he could make that case the way that he did. And he's the only speaker all week who, like, as you said, you're just totally silent in some parts. Just people were hanging on his every word and just, you know, laying out the case for why this election is different, why it's so important, what's at stake for the American people and the American project to go into November and have somebody like Donald Trump compared to our candidate Hillary Clinton was just, he made the case better than anyone probably could have. And I think, obviously for the people in the hall, we're all convinced, we're Democrats who come out to this convention, but the audience across the country who was watching, I think only he could make that argument as well as he did.
Right. And what was kind of intriguing too is, although it was a speech of tremendous eloquence, what I saw over social media repeated and retweeted again and again was his line, "Don't boo, vote."
Vote, yes, absolutely.
As of course, when his speech came to its close, many of us watching were not necessarily fully prepared for the sight of Hillary Clinton herself walking out into that stage. Was that something you anticipated or in any way knew was going to happen?
No, it was wonderful. I mean, it's been an interesting week because in many ways, I mean, this entire week is a crescendo to the speech that she will give tonight. But it's, other than sort of the video that we saw briefly last night by satellite, we've not seen her here. So she's everywhere in terms of, you know, the convention, but she hasn't physically made an appearance yet. So when she came out, it was great. And the other thing that was just so great about that, I mean, you know, the president started by talking about, you know, you guys might not remember, but 8 years ago, I was in this really tough primary battle with Hillary Clinton, and she was tough and reminded us all that, you know, after that was done, instead of pushing her away, he asked her to be the Secretary of State, and she served this country admirably in that role. And so, you know, I think he was reminding everybody that, yeah, we have tough primaries, but when that's done, we've all got to come together and still do the hard work of governing this country. And so for her to come out and, you know, you could just sort of see the gratitude on her face after the president's speech. It was really great to see these former rivals who have been arguably one of the most successful political partnerships in our contemporary time.
Mm. Just a few moments remain. Can you say a quick word about the Democratic nominee for vice president and the kind of impact or impression which you think he made on those of you in the hall?
Yeah, I mean, for a lot of us, I've seen him speak one other time. And so for a lot of us, even, you know, Democratic activists from across the country, Tim Kaine was really introducing himself for the first time. And I think people are very much getting to know Tim Kaine and being inspired by what he stands for. When he started speaking in Spanish and talking about his background as somebody who did missionary work in Central America as a young man, and talking about how we're all Americans, we all matter. I mean, what that means for people of Central American or Latino descent in this country to hear that story and hear those words and be able to hear in their own tongue why that matters and why it's important and that we're all Americans was just really, really very inspiring. Mm. But for a lot of us, this was really getting to know Tim Kaine for the first time, and I'm excited to know more about him and hear more about him in the next 100 days or so.
Very good. State Representative Corey Mason, we look forward to your response to Hillary Clinton's speech tonight on tomorrow's morning show, and I thank you for your time today. Best wishes to you.
Thanks very much, Greg. I'm looking forward to it.
As we enter part two of today's morning show here on WGTD, we want to remind you that support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Here's part two of today's program. For part two of today's morning show here on WGTD, you're going to be hearing a portion of my conversation with best-selling author Larry Tye, whose latest book is called Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. In it, Larry Tye paints a compelling portrait of Robert Kennedy and helps trace his transformation from a fiery anti-communist working for Joe McCarthy in the 1950s to someone who worked passionately for civil rights and against the Vietnam War by the mid-1960s. How did that transformation occur? Larry Tye investigates that. To write this book, Larry Tye was given extraordinary and unprecedented access to a number of archives from the Kennedy family, which have never before been made available to a writer or journalist. He also spoke with a number of people very close to Robert Kennedy and even interviewed his widow, Ethel Kennedy, who has spoken only very sparingly to writers and journalists over the years. The book again is called Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon, published by Random House. One thing I learned from your book, it's not like this is obscure information that you uncovered, but I, for all that I know about the Kennedy family and have read in the past, I never remember learning that Robert Kennedy was the first of the Kennedy sons to marry and the first to give Joe and Rose Kennedy grandchildren. And this is an intriguing factor. And, of course, this is a good moment to talk about the enormous difference which Ethel made in his life. What kind of role do you think she played in who Robert Kennedy went on to become and achieve?
So I actually like hearing you describe all this better than me, because I think you've got it exactly right. She did play the central role in his life. She was the one who, from a young age, they met, as you said, as the youngest of the Kennedy boys, or the youngest of the Kennedy children to get married. And she was the one from the very beginning that gave him the unconditional reinforcement that he had never found at home. Anything he did was right. And she made him think, and I think he was actually right and she was right, made him think that he could achieve even more than his fabulous father, mother, and siblings. And throughout his life, she was this extraordinary blend of partner. Now, I got to tell you, when I use the word partner with her, testing it out, whether that was the role she played, she hates being called partner. She's from an earlier era where she saw herself as very much the junior partner, but she was the one who gave him confidence. She was the one who was the small talker and gabber when he couldn't do that, but was every bit as smart and as determined as he was. And she was the one who, 48 years after her husband died, she says she had all kinds of opportunities to get remarried. She still wears his wedding ring, and she says that why would she remarry? Because he's still up there looking down on her, and she feels his presence every day.
Hmm. I really appreciate later in the book when you quote Robert Kennedy's sober-minded sister Eunice saying that Bobby would never have been the man that he became without his wife. I wouldn't say that about any of my other brothers. And that's a really intriguing insight. And it also gives us a sense that Robert Kennedy was a Kennedy, and yet there was something about him that set him apart from his brothers.
Lots of things that set him apart, and Eunice said it really nicely. Eunice, who wouldn't have had especially complimentary things to say about many people, adored Ethel. And I think that that everybody, probably with the exception of Jackie, saw Ethel as almost Kennedy-like, that she was an in-law, but she was so much like the Kennedys in everything from her high energy level to her athleticism to her understanding politics and how to be a political spouse better than just about anybody. And she certainly settled into that role more comfortably than Jackie did at first.
You describe Bobby Kennedy's schooling, his largely middle-of-the-road successes as a student, and we have very little sense of what great things are ahead for him until he resigns a post he had with the Brooklyn U.S. Attorney's Office to help his older brother, Jack, in his challenge to Republican Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, Jr., of Massachusetts. And this is a critical moment. And it's also a moment in which you suggest that Bobby's father, Joe Kennedy, maybe began to see Bobby in a different light. Explain how this was a crucial moment in both of those respects, in terms of Bobby Kennedy maybe discovering some things about himself, and his own father also maybe seeing him in a new light.
Sure. So I could answer it in one word, which is the word winning. That was the single most important thing to Joe Kennedy. Joe Kennedy didn't care about who came in second in anything. He wanted to know who actually won whatever the contest was. There was no more important contest in the Kennedy family life at that moment than Jack Kennedy becoming a U.S. senator, because that was a clear path from Congress to Senate to, in Joe Kennedy's mind, the only thing that really mattered, which was the White House. And Joe understood that he couldn't pull the strings and orchestrate the campaign. He was too controversial a figure because of the way he had earned his money, because of the appeasing of Nazis that had got him fired by Roosevelt as the U.S. ambassador to Britain during World War II. So if Joe couldn't do it, he knew the one person who could, who'd be as hard-minded and tough as he was, who would control and encourage Jack the way he would. The one person was Bobby. Bobby did that. He won an entirely unlikely race. Beating the Lodges in Massachusetts in those days would be the way it would be a generation later, as difficult as it would have been to beat the Kennedys. They were entrenched. They seemed to make sense for the state, and Bobby Kennedy convinced the state that the white-haired, affable, moderate Senator Lodge was not what they needed. They needed this guy who knew much of anything about, named Kennedy.
Hmm. And you tell us that the more the father heard and saw, including Bobby's record as a single-minded prosecutor and the work he did on this campaign, you write, the better he realized that this was the one of his children who most clearly mirrored his own wants and needs. Bobby understood Joe's bottom-line message that family came before anything, and that in a crunch it was only your siblings and parents you could count on. Bobby felt more deeply and cared more passionately than his brothers and sisters did about matters worldly and personal. He was proudly Celtic, like Joe and PJ, and more Catholic than either of them. He saw the world in the same black and white terms, good guys and bad, as his father did, in contrast to Jack's more nuanced perspective on international affairs. Some of what you say there helps pave the way for an association that will ultimately be perhaps the most controversial and, you say, counterintuitive of Robert Kennedy's career, his association with the infamous Joe McCarthy. Explain to our listeners how that connection began.
So it began, as we're discussing here, like most things in his life, with his father. Joe McCarthy was a great friend of Joe Kennedy's. Joe Kennedy believed in what McCarthy was doing in terms of his, what some would call witch hunting, what others who liked McCarthy would call rooting out communists from the government. Whenever McCarthy was in Palm Beach, he'd stop by to have a drink with Joe Kennedy and a flirt with one of Joe Kennedy's daughters. And when Bobby had graduated from law school and had taken a couple short-term jobs, Joe Kennedy understood that it was time for him to find a real job, and so he turned to his pal, Joe McCarthy, and said, hire my son. McCarthy brought Bobby in, and Bobby embraced McCarthy, partly because his dad said you ought to, and but the equally important reason and the more interesting reason to me in terms of understanding Bobby Kennedy is that he believed that Joe McCarthy was the one politician in Washington who had the courage to go after communists. That Kennedy believed that the Soviet Union was an extraordinary threat to America then. Bobby Kennedy believed it equally strongly, and he was a Cold Warrior conservative in those days, and McCarthy fit his political bill as well as giving him a job and letting him satisfy his dad.
Hmm. You write, Bobby was drawn to qualities in McCarthy that echoed his own, his roughneck spirit, his unapologetic embrace of religion, and his willingness to take on and, if need be, shame the political establishment. It sounds like the really serious tension was not so much at the time between Kennedy and McCarthy as it was between Kennedy and one of McCarthy's most important staff members, a young lawyer by the name of Roy Cohn. What was the problem between those two?
So the problem was partly that neither of them liked one another at all. One was a tough, seat-of-the-pants, Jewish, smart lawyer named Roy Cohn, who had worked his way through law school, graduated at a historically young age, was brilliant, had a photographic memory, and he was the guy who could look out and see in his staff that the guy he was going to have the most trouble with was Bobby Kennedy, because Bobby Kennedy was as hard-nosed as Cohn was and didn't want to be bossed around by a guy who was his contemporary, and that as close as Bobby Kennedy thought he was to McCarthy, Roy Cohn was closer. So Roy Cohn didn't like Bobby Kennedy. Bobby Kennedy hated being bossed around by Roy Cohn. And from the first, they had a conflagration, and they only worked well together when they weren't working much together, when Bobby was off doing his own things. On the other hand, what was short-sighted about Bobby Kennedy was whenever he would look and see the excesses of McCarthy with trampling on civil liberties, with plowing over people and sometimes going off recklessly on charges that he couldn't substantiate, he blamed it all on Roy Cohn. And in fact, Joe McCarthy was very much in charge, and it was not, Cohn may have been irresponsible, but the one we have to blame for that is the boss who let him get away with that. And I think that the interesting thing historically is to see that Bobby Kennedy saw in the course of his life Roy Cohn as one of the three people he hated most virulently than anybody else. It was Roy Cohn and a later guy, a Teamsters leader, Jimmy Hoffa, and the third guy he hated was Lyndon Johnson. But it is today Roy Cohn's name who continues to resonate, that as the New York Times proved recently in a page one story, this very same Roy Cohn was a tutor to a young business guy named Donald Trump, and he was probably his political mentor. So we see resonating 50 years later, Bobby Cohn's archenemy Roy Cohn comes back onto the stage.
Wow. Bobby Kennedy departs the staff of Joe McCarthy, and you'd say his timing was just right, since the Wisconsin senator's worst days were just ahead. Interestingly enough, you tell us the next chapter could not have been more bland, more tedious by comparison, when Bobby Kennedy works for a brief time for ex-president Herbert Hoover, whom he admired. Just say a quick word about this brief chapter in Robert Kennedy's career, and if it matters in the grand scheme of things.
So it matters only because it shows that he, when he was bored, was not especially an easy guy to get along with. This was one of Bobby Kennedy's worst jobs he ever had. It was, again, set up by his father, who was part of Hoover's commission. Hoover was a boring president. He was even more boring when he was running this committee to reorganize the government. Bobby Kennedy had no use for it. He couldn't wait to get out of it. And when he was bored, when he was out in the athletic field, he would get more aggressive. He was just not a pleasant guy to be around during this chapter in his life. That's the bad news. The good news is that very seldom in his work life was Bobby Kennedy ever bored. He had the best jobs you could ever imagine, from being an aide to powerful U.S. senators, to being attorney general, to being a senator. And so this was an interesting phase of his life because it was such an aberration.
Hmm. Bobby Kennedy, of course, returns to Capitol Hill then, not as a representative or a senator, but doing work for which he will generate a great deal of attention and interest. Describe this next chapter of Robert Kennedy's life and career.
Yes. So he returns to Capitol Hill, and the guy in charge of the subcommittee he had worked for McCarthy, is now a very different guy, a Democrat, a crusty Democrat, who doesn't want the spotlight, named John McClellan. And McClellan is determined to go after abuses in unions and management, and ends up picking out, thanks to Bobby Kennedy, one union in particular as a metaphor for all that they thought was wrong in the union movement. And that was the Teamsters, run by the famous leader of the Teamsters who had built it into the nation's biggest and most powerful union, Jimmy Hoffa. And Bobby Kennedy hated Jimmy Hoffa. Hoffa to him represented the perversion of workers' rights and all that unions were supposed to stand for. Bobby Kennedy went after him voraciously for his alleged corruption. And the one thing that Bobby Kennedy couldn't see was that process mattered as well as results. And he was so determined to get Hoffa that the cases they assembled just weren't quite enough to win in court to give the prosecutors enough grist for their mill. And he also couldn't see that there was some other side to Jimmy Hoffa that workers loved and that had them reelecting Jimmy Hoffa by huge margins to the presidency of his union, even as Bobby was trying to tar his reputation. So this was Bobby at his crusading best and at his self-righteous worst.
At one point you write, and this would be in the estimation of those who didn't particularly care for Bobby Kennedy then or now, to doubters, it was young Kennedy applying the worst lessons of McCarthyism. I'm sure even for those who admire him, there's more than a little truth to that charge. What would be some of the clearest ways in which that might have been true?
So it was true in not quite taking seriously that people's right against self-incrimination meant something. The famous Fifth Amendment, Joe McCarthy called the people who took Fifth Amendment communists, and he was trying to suggest that by taking it, they were admitting their guilt. Bobby did the same thing in terms of disparaging the people who came before his committee and refused to testify based on the Fifth Amendment, thinking that that suggested that they had something to hide. And that outraged and rightfully outraged civil libertarians who never quite forgave Bobby for that. And it was the best and the worst of Bobby again. It was his wanting to believe that people should come clean and get up on the stand and tell what they had done or proclaim their innocence openly, but at least answer his questions. And he didn't quite get that how intimidating and how damaging it could be to people who might have been innocent to get up and expose themselves to public testimony. That's why the Constitution protected them, and that's why Bobby Kennedy was, in the end, didn't prevail in many courts of law, because he just couldn't make his case against an awful lot of the people he was bringing up and trying to embarrass in public testimony.
I wonder if you could say a word about how Robert Kennedy himself tended to look back on this chapter of his life. And I suppose I'm even more curious about, because you talk about it in your book, the way in which he framed his experience with Senator McCarthy. And it is though the means by which he could sort of come to terms with that and justify what he did at that point in time, that slightly shifted over the course of time. Can you just say a word about that?
Sure, I can. So at the beginning, I think if I can tell you a quick story, it partly illustrates the best and the worst about his notion of his relationship with Joe McCarthy. And the story is that in 1957, when Joe McCarthy was being buried in Appleton, Wisconsin, a bunch of senators and congressmen flew down on a plane from Washington, and they all get off, 19 senators, 7 congressmen, rest of the dignitaries, they get off and they take their limos from Green Bay at the airport to Appleton for McCarthy's funeral. After everybody has left and after the runway is cleared, one last person gets off that plane, and that person is a young Senate staffer named Bobby Kennedy. He was coming to Wisconsin to honor and to show his loyalty to his friend Joe McCarthy, but he was also coming there as secretly as he could. He begged a ride to town from a journalist. He sat up in the choir loft during the funeral service. At graveside, he stood off to the side. After the funeral, he got that reporter and all the rest of the press who noticed him there to promise they wouldn't write about it. So on the one hand, he was smart enough to know that he ought to show his loyalty and that this is what matters in life. And on the other hand, he was protecting his brother and himself by not embarrassing these supposed liberal Democrats by being there at conservative Joe McCarthy's funeral. Over the rest of his life, he continued to defend McCarthy as somebody he had believed in, but he also, over time, finally came to see that it was not just what McCarthy was doing in crusading for a cause that Bobby believed in, but it also mattered all the victims McCarthy had scattered along the way. And the more tender and the more empathetic Bobby Kennedy became, the more I think he got the downside of Joe McCarthy.
We're speaking with Larry Tai, and his book is called Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. The book explores Bobby Kennedy's life and work, and in particular tries to help explain how Robert Kennedy changed in so many powerful and profound ways. In the chapter called Brother's Keeper, we get a very, very interesting portrait of Robert Kennedy leading various political campaigns for his brother Jack, and of course, most spectacularly, his presidential run in 1960. You tell us that in one of those first campaigns that Bobby helped lead, I think it was that first campaign for U.S. Senate to unseat the incumbent Senator Lodge, you say Bobby put in place a campaign framework more scientific and dynamic than any seen before in Massachusetts. He knew that they would not win if he relied on the Democratic regulars. So what were some of the groundbreaking ways in which Bobby Kennedy shaped that Senate campaign for his brother, a campaign which was ultimately successful, defying the odds?
So he did a lot of things. He, on the one hand, realized that the Kennedy family was one of Jack's best assets, and his sisters and his mother ran Teas for Jack, T-E-A-S for Jack, which were little coffee and tea sessions all across the state. People could come and meet this attractive young candidate, and a disproportionate number of young women showed up to do that. People could come and talk to the famous Rose Kennedy and her daughters, and he understood sort of the personal touch of that kind of thing. He understood at the other end the least personal of campaigning with leafleting every household. He did organizing, sort of door-to-door, district-by-district organizing of the state in a way that had never been done. He divorced the campaign from the old party regulars, including the incumbent governor, and essentially set up a separate campaign. He used Joe Kennedy's millions to finance the campaign. Nothing was too expensive for the Kennedys to do. So he took sort of every technique that had ever been out there. He refined it. He brought it up to the modern era. He made the most expensive, most exhaustive campaign ever, and he made his brother able to respond on a dime to any charges that came up during the campaign, to anything that the incumbent threw at them. He was just masterful in everything that we look at masters like Bill Clinton or Barack Obama in organizing these extraordinary campaigns. Bobby was the one who set the pace for the modern campaign back half a century ago.
And that's something he probably doesn't receive sufficient credit for. You tell us Bobby was the first and singular choice to quarterback the campaign to which all the others had been building, Jack's 1960 bid for the presidency. No one else could be counted on to execute the tactical details and craft a master strategy. No one else could be trusted with the family secrets of paying for and pulling off a venture this bold. There are so many things we could talk about, and I'm tempted to, in fact, maybe we can just spend a moment talking about how the battle plan included 10 primaries, two of which counted. And one of them was for the state from which I'm speaking to you, the state of Wisconsin. Just say a word about why this was so crucial and the success that Jack Kennedy had here.
So it was crucial because Bobby Kennedy realized that Jack had to beat Hubert Humphrey, who was from next door in Minnesota, had to show that he could take on his home turf this very popular Midwestern senator, and that this guy from Massachusetts was up to taking him on and beating him. And Humphrey had much more experience. Humphrey would seem to have a better ground game because all of his troops just had to come across the state lines. And Bobby showed that he could do scientific polling, that he could do lots of ground organizing, and that he could spend Kennedy money in a way that was exasperating to Hubert Humphrey. Hubert Humphrey would look up from his bus that was taking him across the state and see a plane flying overhead and would say, "Jack, come down here and fight fair," because Jack Kennedy was being shuttled around the country and across the state of Wisconsin in a plane. And it was just, it was the proving ground for Jack Kennedy in that 1960 series of Democratic primaries. And he won, and he showed that he could do it by playing fair when he had to, dirty when he had to, and it was essentially the end, the beginning and the end for Hubert Humphrey in that 60 election.
Hmm. One of the most interesting stories of that 1960 race for the presidency is who Jack Kennedy's choice for vice president should be. And of course, we all know who his ultimate choice was, and the fact that this is one of the first instances where the relationship so tense between Robert F. Kennedy and Lyndon Baines Johnson sort of first rears itself. Talk about this choice and how it was a difficult choice, but ultimately, of course, a choice that seems to have paid off handsomely, and what role Robert Kennedy played in that important decision.
So Bobby Kennedy played the role of not wanting LBJ to be the vice presidential choice. He had hated Johnson from the moment they met, when Bobby was a staffer to Joe McCarthy and they ran into one another in the Senate cafeteria. There was something, again, about him, the same way there was about Roy Cohn and Jimmy Hoffa, that Johnson had come up sort of dirt poor, and there was this resentment. Bobby was the rich kid who had had Harvard, who had had anything he needed growing up. These other guys resented him for that. Bobby resented them for their crudeness. Johnson was somebody who would cuss and swear and lie. And Bobby thought that he was exactly the wrong guy to bring into the White House with Jack. And yet, when his brother made the choice, Bobby saw the political brilliance of it. The biggest front that the Kennedys had to worry about was shoring up their southern base. Johnson gave them the South. He gave them Texas. He gave them credibility in terms of being exactly the kind of the older, more experienced senator that Jack Kennedy wasn't. So he gave him a sense of seriousness to go up against an incumbent vice president in Richard Nixon. And on the one hand, Bobby would have rather had a dozen other senators. On the other hand, he was brilliant at making his brother's choices come alive once Jack had told him what the decision was.
Right. And I love the way you summarize Jack Kennedy's eventual decision to make it LBJ. You write that Jack came to see the logic, if not the poetry, in that choice. And once the campaign itself is launched, that is, once it is Kennedy and Johnson as the official Democratic candidates, you talk about how Robert Kennedy was really the mastermind of framing the campaign less around experience. Of course, that would be where Kennedy would be at a deficit compared to Richard Nixon. So he framed the campaign around style and hope. And, of course, that will seem familiar as well to people who have seen a lot of other campaigns waged since then.
It will, and it was all that Jack really had going for him at that point. He didn't have a record, and Bobby understood the thinness of that, and he also understood that people, especially in the 1960s, were ready to look for something new and hopeful, and there's nothing that ever sells better, as we see, as we saw when Bill Clinton ran talking about coming from Hope, Arkansas, as we saw when Barack Obama ran talking about the hope of having the first African-American president, and as we see today when both candidates tout hope, tout greatness, and the issues tend to get lost in things. And Bobby wasn't at all upset to see the issues get lost in 1960, because he knew on the issues Richard Nixon had a resume that was a whole lot thicker than Jack Kennedy's.
Hmm. Jack Kennedy, of course, is elected president, and one of the most fascinating moments in this story and in your book is told in Chapter 4, Getting Justice. And this is the story of how Jack Kennedy ultimately chose his brother Bobby to be his attorney general. It's interesting. it's one of those things where you sort of know certain facts about it, and yet it doesn't strike you maybe the immensity of the risk that was taken in Jack Kennedy selecting Bobby Kennedy to be Attorney General. Just say a word about the way in which this was, in some ways at least, a somewhat audacious choice, and that Robert Kennedy would be, in a sense, an unprecedented sort of choice for Attorney General.
So he was unprecedented. He was the third youngest Attorney General in American history, and the others had come a lot earlier at a time when the office didn't matter as much. He was the closest appointee ever by a president, closest familial appointee to a position that high, and he had never practiced law. He had never had one case in a courtroom. So the idea of picking an attorney general who was your brother, who was your campaign manager, and who seemed eminently unqualified for the position was audacious, was almost reckless, and yet was brilliant. Brilliant because they were so incredibly close, and Jack had somebody he could trust on domestic issues and on foreign policy. And brilliant because whether the issue was going after organized crime or going after segregationists, Bobby Kennedy, I think, will go down in history as very possibly the best attorney general ever.
Hmm. It was a torturous process in terms of trying to decide where Bobby should be in this administration. And some people from the outside looking in viewed his hesitancy as nothing but theater. And I think you see it as something more authentic.
I see it as something definitely more authentic. I think that so Bobby Kennedy was always brilliant at theater, but underlying the theater and the way he got away with all the things that he did throughout his life that were theatrical and that fudged the truth was having enough substance and reality behind them. And I think that when you could combine his theatrical orchestration with his brilliance and his passion for getting real things accomplished, he was this set of contradictions in just about everything he did, including here.
Hmm. So, although it was a unprecedented, preposterous choice, this is the choice that was made. And, of course, Robert Kennedy did indeed serve his brother with great devotion and in your opinion and in the opinion of others with great distinction. Of course, from there, we are already seeing, in a sense, Robert Kennedy somewhat transformed, but still more dramatic transformation is yet to come. So to what do we point in terms of understanding the reshaping of what was most important to Robert Kennedy, and how central to that story is his brother's assassination?
So if there was a single epiphany moment, it was his brother's assassination. Bobby, in an instant, loses his brother, his boss, and his best friend. He loses his reason for being in the world, everything that he had done almost from the moment that he got into public life in a serious way, turned at least in part on his brother and certainly on the family. And now he has no sense of what he's going to do. He goes into 7 months of deep, what I think is clinical depression, and he starts to see the world in a slightly different and more nuanced way. He starts to read Greek tragedy. He starts to understand that Kennedy hubris can end up in losing everything, and he starts to form a personality. We're all at some level a balance between toughness and tenderness, and the tough Bobby starts to really yield to the tender Bobby, and that's the segue into his running for Senate and ultimately running for president as the liberal icon that he was now truly beginning to take shape as.
Hmm. When you describe his run for the U.S. Senate, you describe him, you say Bobby had proven that while nobody was better than he at managing campaigns, he was unseasoned and unsteady as a candidate. just quickly, what are some of the ways in which that was true? And how did he manage to emerge from that unsteadiness to become so much more assured?
So he really started to see that crowds were there not just because he was Jack's brother and because they felt sorry for him, that what he was saying, what he was doing, was really appealing to people. He was speaking to young people. He was speaking to ethnic minorities that are important in New York. He was speaking to people in the city and upstate. And as he became aware that he had something important to say and that he was a separate political and personality generally from his brother Jack, this gave him a confidence that lasted forever for him.
You also say that the Kennedy family leapt into this political race, you say, with even more fervor than they had for Jack's and Ted's campaigns, because Bobby was less of a natural campaigner and needed their help more. It also offered them the same catharsis that it did Bobby. I mean, I'd never stopped to think about this political race in those particular terms. Say a word about Robert Kennedy's struggles to decide whether or not to run for the presidency in 1968.
So the struggles were real. The struggles were partly personality-wise, that he wasn't sure that he was ready for a national scene yet, even though he had been attorney general. Being a candidate was a whole new leap. It was partly a political consideration. He knew that challenging an incumbent president was a difficult thing to do, and it would be much easier rather than jumping in 68 if he could wait till Lyndon Johnson wasn't going to run again 4 years later. And it was an issue challenge to him that he knew that rather than his running encouraging LBJ, could encourage LBJ to sort of back off on the war, he understood that if he jumped into it, it would set off all the wrong competitive impulses in LBJ, and that as seemed to happen every time Bobby would call for a halt in bombing, LBJ would instead increase the bombing of North Vietnam. So we worried about all of those different things, his politics, his personality, and his effect having a negative effect on presidential and national politics. So he delayed jumping in. He made his decision 8 days before the famous New Hampshire primary, where Gene McCarthy showed LBJ's vulnerability, but he didn't announce his decision until 4 days after that primary. So he looked like the ultimate opportunist, and he started out that campaign with a lot of his natural constituency, including young college students, hating him.
Hmm. But of course, he is by this point shaping his own identity, realizing that he needs to forge his own public identity, even those that are distinct from his brother Jack. And what emerges is such a compelling figure in so many different ways. A man still of some contradiction, a man of dual natures, some of a mix of old Bobby and new Bobby. And as we read about that, we just come to appreciate him in so many ways. Even someone who's not going to be politically sympathetic to him, I think, should appreciate just what a fascinating figure he was. You surely came to understand that on the heels of this rich research you did.
Yes, so I think he ended up as the perfect figure, not just for 1968, but the perfect kind of figure for 2016. He was a figure who, rather than creating divisions between ethnic and religious and national groups, he was building bridges between blacks and Hispanics and blue-collar whites and forming a very unusual coalition. More importantly, he was the perfect tender liberal, but also tough-minded one, or if you prefer, he was the compassionate conservative that George Bush coined a term to describe but never quite lived up to. He was this blend of somebody who knew how to get things done, but also was empathetic to people who were suffering. And if that's not the blend for today, I don't know what is.
Mm-hmm. The book is Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon, published by Random House, the author Larry Tai. Larry Tai, thank you so much for crafting such a wonderful book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Best wishes.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Tomorrow on the morning show, one more dispatch from the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia from State Representative Corey Mason, and then a conversation with political science professor Jeff Roberg. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience.